Well, thank you very much for that introduction. One of the difficulties in speaking last on any panel is that the other speakers usually preempt you in one way or another. I shall never forgive Professor O'Keefe for telling the story about Fortnum and Masons, which was meant to be one of the high points of my remarks. On the other hand, I'm deeply indebted to Penelope Neville for reminding us just what a wonderful rhetorician Early was. And also, when she talked about the duty of counsel, sometimes on behalf of their client, to bore the court, she reminded me oh so well of how often we see counsel doing their duty in the court where I now sit. The danger of this kind of reminiscence is that one has to keep in mind that old maxim that a man is only truly getting old when he enters his anecdotage. Ellie was a great master of the anecdote, and I cannot possibly compete with him, but I would like to share a few reminiscences of some of the work that we did together. Roger O'Keefe has particularly mentioned one area of Ellie's academic work, academic and practical, and that was his enthusiasm for collecting and making available to people the raw material of international law. It's worth recalling that it was Ellie who was the first person who tried systematically to collect the state practice of the United Kingdom in the supplement that he published for many years in the International and Comparative Law Quarterly. It was later taken over by others in the British Yearbook, but the inspiration was Ellie's. He did the same with the state practice of Australia when he became the legal advisor to the Australian Foreign Ministry. Now, that's one of the perhaps one of the most important things that any international lawyer can do to make that kind of raw material accessible. Not least because it avoids the kind of academic writing that boldly asserts that something is customary international law. And then when you look at the footnote, it gives you a reference back to the writer's three previous works on the subject, presumably on the basis that anything that you say four times must be true. And it gives the opportunity for the real scholar to refer to the true practice of states. And then there's the International Law Reports. Ellie took over the editorship of the International Law Reports when his father died in 1960, and volume 24 is the volume that the two of them are both cited in as editors. He continued that series for another 145 volumes until his own death, shortly before volume 168 was published. And it was my great privilege to be involved with him in working on 117 of those 145 volumes, of which he was the principal editor. And he was by no means a backstage editor. He took an extremely hands-on interest in everything. You could be absolutely confident that the mistake you allowed to slip through would not escape Ellie's eye. On one occasion, when I was still very young in this profession, one of his youngest apprentices, he spent a good afternoon going through with me a volume of the ILR that I had prepared for publication and showing me one mistake after another, from the typographical error through to the ghastly description of, I think it was India as a colony when it should have been an empire. And then when he saw that I was looking a little downcast, he said, "Oh, don't worry about it, Chris. My father always used to say he'd never opened one of his books without finding a mistake of some kind in it." That was extremely cheering. Now, if working on the raw materials of international law sounds rather dull, and Ellie, in his wonderful interviews with Leslie Dingle, did describe himself at one stage as a bit of a dull boy, it couldn't, in fact, be further from the truth. In the first place, Ellie brought to the publication of the ILR that enormous entrepreneurial enthusiasm he showed. How many of us in academic life, when we've had an argument with our publisher, respond by setting up a publisher of your own? He brought a schoolboyish enthusiasm to it. When he found a new case he was unaware of, he was practically hopping about with pleasure in his study when he would tell me about it and insist that we scrap whatever schedule for publication we'd just achieved and rush this one through into press as quickly as possible. Sometimes I had to take issue with him about it. the occasion when he suggested that we print a series of Vatican decisions from the 1580s that a fellow of Trinity had drawn to his attention, I did have to say that it sat rather oddly with the policy we'd announced in a recent foreword to the ILR, that we would henceforth be concentrating on cases from the last 10 years. And then there was the creativity he showed when we had problems. One of the first cases I helped him to write up was the award in the case between British Petroleum and Libya. Now, as this was a private arbitration, we needed the consent of both parties to publish it. BP were immensely enthusiastic. Ellie, who'd been counsel for BP, then wrote to Libya to ask their permission. And this was in the late 1970s. Writing to the Libyan government wasn't quite as straightforward then as it later became. And he got a fascinating letter back saying that the government of Libya could not give its consent in relation to something which was such an obvious travesty of its sovereignty as to amount to a legal non-entity. We published it anyway with a note by Ellie in the preface saying, Ellie interpreted this as meaning that the Libyan government considered that there was no award, therefore nothing to which they could consent or withhold publication. And then there was the way in which he managed to inspire the many of us who worked on that series, and I see many of them here, Karen Lee, Donata Rigarabamu, Cairo Robb, and several others. He was, I think, a wonderfully inspiring man to work with. He really was a master craftsman who wanted to make sure that the apprentices who worked with him grew up to love the tools and the raw material with which they worked. And that inspiration led many of them to go on to fascinating careers in international law, and some to slightly different walks of life. It was a bit of a surprise to both of us when one of the earliest assistants on the ILR went off to be the centrefold in Playboy a few months after she had left us. Her modesty covered, if indeed one could even describe it as that, only by one volume of the International Law Reports, very strategically placed. Ellie's reaction was to look at me quizzically and say, Chris, was that why you suggested we should increase the page size of the series? But I think the ILR will, I hope, remain forever a memorial to Ellie's enormous contribution in bringing the raw materials of international law to our attention. Now, if I may, I'll just change for a moment to say a little bit about advocacy and Ellie as a barrister. A little bit less than I was going to say originally, Mr. Chairman. Ellie's career as an advocate at the International Court of Justice spanned just over 60 years. He first appears in the ICJ's reports in the 1953 preliminary objections phase of Nottebohm, though he didn't have a speaking part in that case. And his last appearance is in 2014 in the Timor-Leste and Australia case. That's a record that has never been matched, and I think we can fairly confidently say never will be matched by anyone in the future. And he was a magnificently stylish advocate. The ICJ is not perhaps the forum where we hear advocacy at its finest on some occasions, but we certainly heard it at its finest from Ellie. I'll just quote two examples. The first was the nuclear tests application in 1995. Ellie had appeared in the nuclear test case in the 1970s on behalf of Australia. But there was, of course, a parallel case brought by New Zealand. And in 1995, the New Zealand government tried to fasten on to a passage at the end of the 1974 judgment, referring to France's undertaking not to conduct future atmospheric nuclear tests, and get the court to reopen the proceedings on the basis that the new decision to conduct underground nuclear tests at Mururoa, in the light of the knowledge about environmental damage that existed by the 1990s, should be regarded as a violation of that undertaking given in 1974. Now, that was always going to be an extremely difficult argument. Counsel for France came without their robes, because they didn't consider it was a proper case. It wasn't really a proceeding before the International Court of Justice. Ellie had to carry the burden of explaining the scientific evidence.
And he did this with great elan and tremendous charm, saying, "There is the difficulty that I, as a non-scientist, have to stand here and explain it to you, the judges of the court. But there is one consolation you can take. If I can explain it, you can certainly understand it." It was perhaps one of the finest examples of the tradition of the English bar that even if you never heard of the particular area in question before you were briefed in the case, you can still get it up well enough to explain it to a lay audience, lay in terms of the specialist area. The second example I was going to give was Qatar and Bahrain. Ellie didn't just refer to Rentokil and Fortnum and Masons. He had a visual aid. He produced a pot of Fortnum and Mason's Gentleman's Relish, which he held up and asked the court, "Was this British government state policy?" Whether any of the judges proceeded to try the Gentleman's Relish in the privacy of the Restaurant des Juges, we'll never know. But again, it was good humour, but it was fantastically effective. It was impossible, seriously, to put forward the Qatari argument about the provenance of the map once it had been taken apart in this way. And the third example comes from the Timor-Leste and Australia case. Now, by this stage, Ellie was quite an old man. He addressed the court from a seated position, which is something which, of course, the court is happy to accept. But nevertheless, two memories remain vivid in my mind about it. This is the one time when I had the privilege of hearing Ellie when I was on the bench and he was at the bar. The first is the enormous importance he attached to integrity. The case concerned the seizure of Timor-Leste's legal papers from the offices of their lawyer in Canberra, papers that concerned a pending arbitration between Australia and Timor-Leste. And Ellie was ferocious as an advocate in referring to what was and was not proper practice in relation to looking at another client's paperwork. The second was the sheer command that even at 85 he had in that court. We always break for a coffee break somewhere between 10 past and 20 past 11. Usually, the president decides for himself or herself when that break will take place. Or possibly counsel would say in a self-deprecating way, "Mr. President, if this might perhaps be a convenient moment, you might wish to take a break." Ellie just looked at the president and said, "Mr. President, I think this would be a good moment for us to stop, as I'd like to collect my thoughts for a while." We stopped. Penelope said that if you look at the big cases Ellie fought, and it's worth remembering he was an exceptional advocate in the English courts as well, and the style of the ICJ does not necessarily carry over into a court where you're interrupted every 5 minutes by a judge who wants to ask difficult questions. Many advocates who are excellent in international tribunals cannot manage it at all in a place like the House of Lords Appellate Committee or the Court of Appeal, or nowadays the Supreme Court in this country. Ellie certainly could. But Penelope made the point that many of his big cases were cases that he lost in whole or in part. I think I have an explanation for that, and it's certainly not one that reflects ill on Ellie as an advocate. I once heard somebody say, "If you have a good case, you can go to any lawyer. If you have a weak case, go to Ellie Lauterbach." I don't think there could be a finer tribute to him as an advocate. Let me, in conclusion, just make one other point. In this panel, and I dare say in the next one, we've talked about individual parts of what Ellie did. But there can be no question that his really is a case where the sum was very much greater than the total of the parts. And looking at him as an advocate, as a scholar, as a teacher, as a legal advisor, as a negotiator of treaties, as somebody who dealt with boundaries, land and maritime, in four different continents, we should never lose sight of the warmth, the generosity, the humanity, the energy, the enthusiasm, the desire to create, and the ability to inspire that was so much the hallmarks of the rounded man. Thank you.